Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. I'd like to thank all of the Phantom Astronaut patrons for supporting the show. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the show, visit phantomastronaut.com for all the different ways that you can help us continue to create. Today, I'm joined by author and music journalist, Tim Riley. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining me.
It's nice to be here.
So, I'm familiar with your work from a lot of different places. You put out some very interesting books. The Riley Rock Index is something I check out pretty often. But could you contextualize sort of your background and your current projects for the audience?
Sure. So, let's see. My first book dates me back to 1988. So my very first book was Tell Me Why. And that book sprung out of a class that I had been teaching while I was going to music school. And I went to music school as a piano player. I was a performance major, both my undergrad and graduate. And I just kept feeling like there was so much more to say about rock and roll than so many of the critics I was reading. And that the musicologists that I was studying music with were really underestimating the sturdiness of this music, the sophistication of this music, and its staying power. It was pretty clear to some of us that, we were going to be listening to the Beatles for a long time, that this was not like they weren't going to be stuck and we weren't going to forget. And so I just started building my course around that. And that grew into my first book, which was called Tell Me Why. And I'm very proud that that book has stayed in print all these years, still in print. And I think that most people know me through that book. And I actually felt like it was a dream come true to write the book because I'd been burning a hole in my head my whole life long. But I also felt like I didn't understand why no one else had taken on a critical book on the Beatles. Like there were picture books and there were biographies. There were two kinds of books, maybe three, two picture books, biographies, and then I was there. I was in the room when this happened. So the sort of, the wife's books and the roadie's books and all of that. And I just found those books really, really wanting, really just not very interesting as a musician, right? Trying to figure out, well, there's something extraordinary going on here. Everybody knows it, but can we describe it? Can you quantify it? Can you sort of get your mind around it? What would that look like, right? And it took a lot of work. It was really heavy lifting, that book, but I learned a lot about writing and how to lay out a book and all of that stuff. And they were very patient with me. I was very lucky to have a really good publisher. And, it's fun to go back to and look at it. I'm a different person now because that's such a long time ago. It kind of just doesn't seem real, but it's 35 years ago or whatever. And then I did not expect that I would wind up writing three books on the Beatles, but, circumstances and career choices. So after that book, I wrote the Dylan book, Hard Rain, and I wanted to shift gears and to show that I could write about a different kind of music and that I wasn't going to just be musicological, that they actually could get a grip on folk music and write well about folk music and a completely different tradition. And then I was going to write my third book on the Rolling Stones because I was going to do the big three, and Knopf did not want a book on the Rolling Stones. And I was really like, I was aghast. I was like, this is just can't be happening. So the other book I really wanted to write was on gender and rock and roll, and I couldn't sell that book either. So I took a contract to write a book on Madonna, which was sort of a quickie, and that book came out, and that was whatever. I was really into Madonna. I felt like Madonna was a rock and roll figure and that we needed to put her in the rock and roll context. She seemed to be sort of like playing as though she didn't participate in the rock and roll context. And I felt like she definitely did, and that she learned a lot from Dylan, and that like Dylan, she was underrated as a singer. So I wanted to make those arguments. And then I sort of lost the thread, and the gender book sold, but not for very much money. So I started working freelance and doing some other things and just kind of writing on the side. And we finally got the gender book out in 1992 after a long period where just lots of other stuff was happening. And then Is that right? 92 or 2002? I get mixed up. I get totally mixed up when these things come out. But there was a certain point that where I had done a lot of editorial work on the web, was scrounging around for different things. I'd done a lot of public speaking on college campuses on the First Amendment, because in 1990, the Mapplethorpe scandal blew up and they needed someone to be a speaker. And all of a sudden, if you're an author, you're an expert. So I was really like jazzed to be able to speak on that subject. And I learned a lot about the First Amendment. And so I did a lot of campus lectures on that. And I was freelancing for NPR and different places and kind of doing this and that. And then came a point where I was out of editorial work and I had to figure out a new big book project and really go big. And that was 2003. Yeah, that was 2003. And that was, I think actually that the gender book took that long to come out. I think the gender book took, like, it didn't come out till 2002. Anyway, I sold the Lenin book. And my observation at that point was that we needed a new Lenin biography. There'd been plenty of new scholarship to get to, but the last American Lenin biography had been written by this clown named Albert Goldman. And the Goldman book is really a disaster, and it has a lot of misinformation and a lot of disinformation. And I just saw this opening. I couldn't believe like nobody else was going and saying, hey, we need a new Lenin biography. So I just leveraged my Beatle expertise and pointed it in a new direction. And, you know, I was very, very fond of the way everyone is very fond of Peter Guralnik's Elvis Presley biographies. And I wanted to do something similar for Elvis. But I also wanted to write about how Americans see Lenin very differently than the British do. And I had an experience in London that I talk about. There was a guy who was a Beatle guy in London I was interviewing. And I asked him how he liked the Bob Spitz book, which had just come out. Which was really kind of, it was weird to have the Spitz book come out while I was working on that Lenin book. But the Spitz book came out, there was a big noise and everything, and he had new scholarship in there. But I was like, so what do you make of this? And he looked at me like I was from Mars, like why would you even think about asking me about that? And he said, well, it certainly was written from the American point of view, which was the very polite British way of saying, you guys pretty much screw up this topic every time you write about it, and you guys have no clue. Like, you don't get the Beatles unless you're British. And I thought, aha, that is such a great theme. That's going to make that a central theme, because the British really, they're proprietary, which is completely understandable. But the basic British attitude is still to this day something like, you know, if he hadn't run off with that wacky Japanese-American avant-garde artist, he might still be alive. Like, we have blood on our hands, right? And that is really an interesting undercurrent to the way they think about Lenin books and the way they write their Lenin books. And so I was very happy to get a really rave review in the London Times because of that. So several British people gave me good reviews, and I thought, oh, I must have done something right there. And I think a lot of it for me was really interesting, because I really wanted to tell the story, the history of rock and roll, through Lennon's ears. And I think Lennon has a pretty great ear, and that his frame on rock and roll is actually turned into pretty much the classic frame, but we don't sort of acknowledge that. So the Beatle live repertoire that Mark Lewisohn wrote about in his first book, and that we sort of got to know a lot better through all of the BBC recordings where they started releasing those in the early 80s, was that they had really sort of figured out what the core repertoire of the rock and roll canon was going to be. And that vision of rock and roll history is still pretty much the one that everyone uses. So I've been accused several times of having my view of rock history be pretty Beatles-centric, which is true. But I actually think the larger point is that the Beatles' view of rock and roll has become pretty standard, pretty mainstream. And I really liked researching that and digging into that and figuring out what all of that meant. You know, it means Buddy Holly counts for a lot more than for most Americans' minds. Buddy Holly doesn't count for nearly as much as he does in British minds. All right, that's a big deal. And the fact that they name themselves after the critics, that's like a very important stroke of theirs. And they mean it to be a very significant stroke. And Americans really just don't, we're just sort of not tuned into that level of it. The other guy who's really big over there is Eddie Cochran. Yeah. And I fell in love with Eddie Cochran working on this book. And he just looms really. He's up there with Buddy Holly in the British imagination, in large part because he died over there. So when Andrew Lou Goldham writes his memoirs, there's two memoirs, Stoned and Too Stoned. And he writes about Cochran's spilled blood on British soil. You know, he's like a Christ figure. And that whole theme of, so rock and roll has different threads, and it strikes the British imagination differently over there than it does over here. That I just found really, really interesting, and I wanted to dig into that. So that's more what I do in the Lennon biography. And then what? And then what happened? Then someone wanted a Beatle textbook. So I did a Beatle textbook with Walter Everett from University of Michigan. And he had been teaching Beatles a lot, and he had a lot of great material. And I had my own vantage, and we sort of combined and wrote stuff back and forth and did the collaboration. And it still is the only Beatle textbook out there. And I was surprised again, A, to be writing about the Beatles, but B, to be like finding lots of new ideas and lots of new sources. And like, it was still really interesting to write about. I still can't believe how sturdy all that music is. So that's that. And then in 2009, I started teaching digital journalism here at Emerson College. And I've been doing that for 15 years. And that's been great and cool. And I teach cultural criticism and music criticism and digital journalism. And it's been really interesting to come at the whole subject of the history of rock and roll as a pedagogue, because you realize pretty quickly that the students don't have the same cultural references as you do. They grew up in a world that rock and roll created, and to persuade them how subversive the energy in rock and roll was in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up, it's very hard to do, because now it's just normal. Like everyone dresses casual to work at school. Like, rock and roll's influence can be felt pretty much every corner of society, and I watched it happen, and it was never supposed to last this long. I mean, the weirdest thing about rock and roll history is that it's still around. And for them, but you grow up with it, and it's like, oh, well, this is my parents' music. And it's a hard thing to try and persuade them how it was both popular, yes, very popular, but also it was expressing a counter-establishment viewpoint. Like, it was, politically, it was very, very subversive. So it's been really interesting to kind of try and get a handle on that and learn how to teach it well. And so there's that. And a couple of years ago, I started my Substack, which is called the Riley Rock Report. And because I had been contributing to the Phoenix and NPR for many years, I have assembled an archive, and at some point it will be an anthology. But I'm pegging things to people's birthdays, anniversaries, and I'm alternating between historical articles that I've written before and contemporary art. So my theme is, I kind of like to think about my theme is how you can hear the threads of music history show up in pop culture today. Right. So Beyonce is a really good example of that. Beyonce doing this country and Western move is really fascinating. You could hear a lot of the country records that she loves in that number. Right. And of course, because she's Beyonce, everyone's freaking out. And it's actually like, no, it's actually a very normal thing. And Bray Carter and, you know, many other figures are now like, it should not be such a, you know, people should not be having spaz attacks when marginalized people participate in country music, because they were always there. So a lot of interesting stuff going on.
So you've touched on a ton of things, and I think this might be a good place to start. So in your teaching, you mentioned that you teach both digital journalism and cultural criticism, and, you know, those two play back and forth. And I can see all that, you know, kind of coming through a lens of music very, very easily, because what people who are under a certain age tend to not realize just about the artists and the impact that they had from what you discussed is also that we didn't really have the kind of mass media. It just didn't exist technologically, you know. And of course, you know, the Beatles, Love Is All You Need Is Love, Around the World, Satellites, you know, however many people watching at one time, that whole idea that the world can participate in a cultural moment or something like that, that's very passé now, because, you know, you might see a viral meme, everybody knows it, and, you know, that pops up every week or every couple of days. One thing I'm thinking of right now is that there's that Willy Wonka disaster experience that happened in Glasgow that's kind of been dominating my feed, and it's just all different permutations of this weird cultural thing that really should just be like a local, people wanted refunds for this event, you know, kind of a story, but it kind of touched the imagination, and now billions of people are, you know, sharing images and things about that. That kind of technology was completely alien to the cultural landscape, and what you end up with is you get bands like the Beatles, who really are almost, in a way, the first meme, because they combine a style, a fashion, a visual culture, a sound that, you know, is of course rooted in you know, previous rock and roll and blues and everything, but, you know, it's attached to this visual component, and they have unique personalities, and it sort of blossoms during this telecommunications era. And everything that we're experiencing now sort of follows on in a way from that. So if you look at this whole debacle about recently the Super Bowl with Taylor Swift, and everybody was freaking out, especially the conservative media, you know, freaking out about the power that Taylor Swift has, and she's going to, you know, go on there and change something potentially about the election for the presidency, and all these conspiracy theories and things like that. And Beyonce's actually been attached to a couple of these Super Bowl conspiracies as well. I mean, that cultural power of music is something that is still very vibrant, very potent, and drives so much of our lives that you have people that are incredibly well-platformed political pundits still freaking out over something that a musical artist says. It's a complete invention of the last, what, 70 years, roughly?
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that. And part of what the Beatles did that was so infectious and charming was that they simply adopted and transmitted their messaging through the most advanced technological systems at the time. And they made it look like completely natural, like we were just born to be recording artists, which was not a thing before the Beatles, right? We were just born to make these 8-track, you know, put 2 8-track machines together and do this overdubbing and make these recordings. And they just participated in that era's technology in a way that just sounded completely natural and whimsical and just right, you know, like the, that's a, they made it like seem like that's what the technology was for, right? and great art does that. And now we have, you're right, we have like this burgeoning, this mushrooming of technology and these, you know, multiple screens. I've lost count of how many screens are in my house these days, right? And, you know, we see the influence of the Beatles there. And I think mostly what I see is people are trying to act as nonchalant and as ironic and as outré as the Beatles. In other words, the Beatles made it seem easy, but we know how much hard work went into those recordings now. I think we're seeing a lot of the influence of it, but we still haven't seen a repetition of that kind of joie de vivre, you know, through the technology. They had a really winning way with just presenting themselves on television and on the radio and through recordings that seemed like beyond natural, like almost supernatural. And I think, I mean, for me, I haven't seen a performer who does that again, but I'm biased because I grew up and the Beatles were, right, when I was young, they were just like the heaviest influence. And if you grow up and the Beatles are living, breathing people while you're alive and they're still putting out records and they're on TV, and then, you know, I watched the whole breakup and all the solo careers and everything. For me, it was an epic, you know, it was an epic story that was getting told on a vast scale and across many decades now. So I just have this bias that it's like nobody has really chased the same level of poetry that the Beatles did, but I try to be accepting. I mean, I do admire many, many bands since the Beatles. I just think they have a real special quality that combines so much that most other acts just are able to grab pieces.
Where do you think music journalism, commentary, you know, everything within that sphere, what is your outlook for the future of that? And I get concerned because just recently we saw Pitchfork shutting down. We saw, you know, Vice is no longer going to publish on vice.com. You know, I've been seeing smaller outlets and things get consolidated and kind of evaporate. There are a couple of people that I know that are also starting Substacks, but, you know, it's harder to reach a sizable audience, you know, with your individual efforts instead of like the kind of traditional magazine model. Like where I started my career, I started in music photography. So, you know, back in the 90s, I was shooting acts like Violent Femmes and Dandy Warhols and folks like this. And, you know, I was getting published in traditional print magazines, sometimes, you know, big ones like Spin and stuff like that, and sometimes regional and whatever else. But it was a fairly robust market that just doesn't exist anymore for that kind of documentation. And I'm worried that the written side, the criticism side, the journalism side is facing a future where it's going to be very difficult to find platforms for this kind of content.
Yeah, so the irony about the web and, you know, like it's much easier to reach a wider audience now if you're a single person than having to go beg an editor, pitch an editor to buy your stuff. But the irony is it's harder to sort of cultivate and market and win that big audience unless you're hitched to a larger brand. I do think there's too much doom and gloom in the air. I think journalism is going through a rough patch, but I think people who go into journalism to make money are just wrong-headed. I just think they're wrong-headed. And we keep learning this over and over and over again. And Vice is a particularly good example. Okay. I always thought Vice was a bunch of hot air, right? We're young, hip. We're going to do different versions of these stories. We're going to get into the muck about. And I never saw Vice do anything that made me think, oh, this is a completely new kind of journalism, or, oh, they really figured out how to tell this story in a new way, or, oh, you know, nobody can name me three stories that Vice broke before anybody else. It was never like they were a major player ever, but they talked as though we're going to hit the youth market, we're going to carve this thing out, and we're going to throw lots of money at it, and that's what's going to make it successful. We're going to be edgy. And it just always seemed like a bunch of hot air to me, and I never saw like this come through.
It was a little bit like the I don't want to say respectable. I don't even know, upmarket maybe is the term. They were kind of marketing themselves as like an upmarket Maxim or Lad Bible or one of those kind of things. That's how I always perceived them.
Yeah, and you know, you see publications go through these. You know, Maxim had its moment, right? It was a real late 90s moment, and what was it? It was just TNA. I mean, that's all it was.
Yeah.
And so we see them. I just have seen too much of it. I've grown very cynical over the years. But if you're a billionaire and you want to like throw your weight around and think you know more about the world than anyone else, and you start a publication so you can get this point of view across, you're just it's really hard to make money. Very, very few people figure out how to make money. And the ones that do, like the Rupert Murdochs of the world, they have all kinds of political favors they're calling in and all kinds of regulations that they're able to sidestep in order to dominate the markets the way they do. And they're never held accountable for any of the woeful sorrow that they reap. So I think we're going through a rough patch. I think it will shake down okay. I think criticism will be okay. It's been embattled before. I don't see this as the doom and gloom moment for criticism. You know, I think 10 years out, we'll be like, oh, remember when Pitchfork died? We thought that was the end. It's like, No, it's not the end. Like, there'd be another pitchfork type thing. Someone will be stupid enough to start up another vice or another pitchfork, and it'll go along, and it'll either do it right or it won't. And mostly they don't, right? Mostly publications fail. And in order to get a sustainable business model, you have to have kind of clear eyes, and you have to say, you know, some of this is not going to be money making. Like, some of the stuff that we publish is going to be like unpopular. I mean, this is a very ancient editorial question, right? Publishing what people want versus publishing what they need, right? And if everyone's chasing clicks, and there's these people who are just chasing clicks right down into the muck, that's, you know, that can drag a whole country down. Who knew? But does it mean that it has to be that way, or that it's preordained to be that way, or that, you know, criticism wouldn't survive? You know, if we're looking at a second Trump election, will criticism survive? Of course it will. It'll just look different and feel different. It'll find different. It may be underground for a while, right? But there's no doubt in my mind that criticism will survive. People want criticism a lot more than they are able to articulate, right? People love consuming pop culture, and they really love it when people help them understand it better. That really does happen, and it happens in a lot of different ways, and there is a market for that. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's as big a market as a Marvel comic book movie, but there's definitely a sliver of the market that, you know, I found this movie really stayed with me in ways I'm really having trouble pinpointing, and then they come across a review that helps them focus on exactly what it is that created that tension and gave them something beyond entertainment as that movie. And people like that and want that, but it's not at the top of mind for most people.
Mm. Right? Yeah, I think, I guess from my perspective, I've seen these changes, and like you said, they go in cycles, but the value of it being tied to, probably in the last 15 years, the emphasis that I've seen on views and engagement and all these sort of marketing-y, ad salesy kind of buzzwords, it has been so great that it's seeped itself into the unconscious mind of anybody who is in the business of publishing material, that when you start to see these things happen, it's maybe a bit of an illusion, right? It's we're worried about these things. We go, oh, well, that's, you know, I'm not getting a million views on my Substack, but I used to get a million views every year. Does that really matter? Was that translating directly in the same way to your ability to sustain a living? Does it mean that I think that we tie ourselves to statistics like that in a way that I didn't see in the 90s. I didn't see it in the early 2000s, and it's become part of the culture. And I think there has to be a little bit of deprogramming out of that for people who are getting into the industry now.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And the frame I put on it is that we are literally in the Neanderthal stages, this new, whatever you want to call it, the social media culture, the mass web culture, the globe on your phone. And I think we're still sorting out a lot of really fundamental things, like how do we express our values here? Somebody pointed out, forget who it was, but you know, that the whole Twitter scene. So I just left Twitter, well, you know, like 6 months ago, because I couldn't stand, you know, that what Twitter was happening. But even on Instagram and some of Substack, you get the trolls and you get the snark, and what you get is a context-free take on something, and it takes a lot more reading and a lot more understanding and a lot more lived experience to make sense of those things. And I think we're all still adjusting to it. It's like adjusting, but it's like, you know, what was it like to adjust to the Telegraph when, you know, before it took you 3 months to figure out that your grandma in California had died, because it took 3 months for the Post to deliver that news. And then all of a sudden, pretty much overnight, well, roughly overnight, like, you would get a telegram, and this was instantaneous, right? This was fairly, this threw people for a loop. Like, this was really kind of hard to adjust to, because it seemed as though life was moving at a different pace. It wasn't really, but the messaging was starting to go faster, and the world seemed a lot smaller very quickly. And I think we're going through a major adjustment, and that a lot of that will shake down too. You know, some of the same, you know, the stuff we're hearing about Substack, a lot of the same arguments were happening around blogs in the earlier part of the century. And I wrote a blog for 15 years. Kind of can't believe it. And it's over. You know, like my blog day, I don't blog anymore. But that used to be the popular mode, right, for critics. And everyone had a blog. And yeah, I think, you know, Substack's just the latest thing. I think that the newsletter thing is, I think it's actually a lot more fragile than people are perceiving it to be. I think it's very noisy. It's overcrowded. I don't think the model is sustainable. I don't think that people are going to have 5 and 6 paid Substack subscriptions in the next 5 years. I just don't think that. It does not look like, I could be wrong, but I think we're going to see all kinds of new bundling services, and you're going to get these 3 Substacks for this one low rate of $50 or whatever. I mean, they're going to start consolidating. There's going to be advertising, right? Anything that's successful, it's going to start getting polluted by all that typical capitalist stuff. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. For now, what's fun about Substack is that it's busy inventing itself. So you can see it actually growing the way you used to see like Facebook growing or Twitter growing. And it's kind of small enough now that it has its sacred cows, and it's, you know, it's got it's a small town. In web terms, it's a small town compared to like Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun that way because it's still sort of growing and inventing itself. It's also just turning out to be a really important space for music. So
I'm already starting to see what you're talking about, this bundles and consolidation. I don't know if you follow what goes on YouTube, but a lot of people who make these video essays, some of them about music, some of them about whatever other topic, they almost use their YouTube videos as teasers. They've grown very, very big audiences there, and they send them to this creator-owned collective platform called Nebula. And, uh-huh. You know, it's a subscription service, and it's like, oh, if you want to learn more about this, if you want the 30-minute long video, sign up to my Nebula. So it's kind of interesting that we're already starting to see that in its infancy, but it is happening.
Yeah. I think we'll see a lot. I mean, when I started teaching here at Emerson 15 years ago, the idea that everyone getting their news on their phones was remote. I mean, it was like, oh, that's weird. Could that happen? Maybe, but it did not seem like an inevitable thing. There's probably stuff that we'll be doing in 15 years that we have absolutely no idea because the technology isn't even there yet. Remember how, the word disrupt has turned into a horrible cliche, right? But Google came along. I worked on the Lycos search engine for the Lycos company, which was out here. And we were busy trying to figure out how to get people to search and how to deliver better search results and everything. And all of a sudden, Google came along. It just changed the game, right? And those kinds of things keep happening, and they keep happening more and more. Like the acceleration in technological change, the pace has picked up so much that I get very, very skeptical with people saying, oh, well, you know, Pitchfork, that means the criticism may be dying. It's like, I've seen this happen a million times. I do think that demand for content is higher than ever. And I do think that the business people have not been held accountable for how to harness that demand. Their job is to figure out, how do we harness the demand? How do we advertise against it? How do we charge for subscribers? How do we make money off of it? If this demand is higher than ever, 100 years from now, they're going to look back and say, they still hadn't figured out how to make money on that thing, you know, because the world is full of experts on how to make money. But you have these products where the demand is through the roof, right? Demand for news is through the roof. We cannot keep up with the demand, but nobody's making money on it. That's a ridiculous situation. But it's not a journalism problem. It's a business problem, right? And how come we're not saying to Wall Street, hey, how come you guys are building up all this phony stock on really, really just fumes, but you still haven't figured out how to make money on Twitter? I mean, are you kidding me? It's just ridiculous. And it's because, all of these old traditional models don't work. They're throwing everything on the wall. Nothing is sticking. It's like, we need to figure out new models. And journalists are busy doing that, right? So the nonprofit model for journalism looks very, very promising, especially for local news. And that's just basically what I've been saying. journalism was not invented to be a cash cow. It never has been a cash cow. It's always had some kind of support from the government or from advertising or from, and, you know, when people made a lot of money out of journalism, it was the exception, not the rule. I think we have to rid ourselves of this notion that we're all going to make a lot of money being journalists.
There's an element of honesty, which I think anybody who creates online content needs to express to be successful in the ecosystem. And I think that ties back to what you just said about like nonprofit models and things like that. The most successful people that I've seen are people that just flat out say, you know, hey, if you like this, if you want to keep supporting me doing this, you know, here's pay what you can or subscribe over here or do this, but this helps me to continue to make content. And that very simple message, that simple, honest, straightforward message seems to translate to the, you know, highest level of success in that space. So I think that's very telling, that the relationship between audience and author, or, you know, journalist or video creator or whatever it is something that can be cultivated and can be stronger than ever.
Well, we're certainly seeing a lot of success stories. Again, I separate the short range from the long range, right? So, you know, people who are busy making money on Substack right now, will they be the same people making money in 5 years? I don't know. I mean, some of those people are churning out 3 essays a week. I mean, that's a pretty tough grind, right? And, you know, you do that for 3 or 4 years and you burn out. It's just, it's so predictable. And then you get people who are like, you know, I used to like it, but I'm just sort of sick of it now. I'm not going to re-up next year. So they subscribe for 1 or 2 years and then they dump it. So you're into the same kind of challenges, right? But it just has all this noise around it now because people are making a success of it. People are making really good coin on Substack. Power to them, right? But I worry about the long term. I mean, I'm just really curious about in the long term, will we be talking Substack in 10 years?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit to the Beatles, because, you know, I'm trying to remember when it was. Was it a month, 2 months ago? They released this AI-assisted new single. What did you make of that?
Well, first of all, so I just have to get my cynicism out of the way, right? I followed the Beatles for 50 years. And, you know, what has happened since the breakup in 1970 is they have really learned how to keep marketing themselves and to stay at the forefront of everybody's idea of, you know, rock and rock history. And in a way, you know, sort of what they've been selling is a perceived relevance, right? Even though they're no longer a band, they're no longer making relevance, we still think of the Beatles. And I'm just cynical enough about that, but it cuts both ways. I mean, there's been a lot of box sets that have been really tremendous and, you know, great fun to dive into. And so I don't want to slag on it, but it is very calculated. And this was clearly done to the Now and Then thing was done to promote the remasters of the blue and the red compilations. I thought it sort of Get Back. It sort of like had the wrong marketing tag. It was Beatles, AI does the Beatles, right? Well, it was a very particular piece of AI. It was not that AI was making any sounds. It was that AI was helping isolate voices. And we knew that Peter Jackson had developed this while he was working on Get Back. And it was actually a really, really interesting and insightful kind of technology to participate in, because you could actually do a really clever, not clever, you could do a very interesting mix of the voices the more you could isolate them, right? So it's very interesting technology and it's very useful, but it's a real geeky thing. It's like engineering, like it's for engineers. But people heard this headline, Beatles in AI, and they thought there was some synthetic, some weird magical computer, some code got inside. You know, it's like, that's not what it was. So there's a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of, you know, just AI was like having its year, right? Having its moment, like everyone is buzzing about AI. I like the song better than the other two songs that Lennon had had given the Beatles in the 90s, better than Free as a Bird and better than Real Love.
I
don't know. For me, it didn't like sweep me off my feet and fill me full of nostalgia and make me rapturous for more Beatle music or sentimental for the old days, whatever. I thought it was decent. I thought it was a B or a B plus, right? And I thought the production was probably the most interesting thing about it. I thought the video was embarrassing. I mean, just plain embarrassing, hard to watch. I was much, much bigger fan of Get Back. But, you know, again, I think that they buried the lead. I think the lead was in the mixing it did of all of these Beatles singles. And I think those Blue and Red album remasters that we're listening to, I'm having this another, you know, it's like the 2009 remasters. I can't believe it. I'm hearing new things in these Beatles mixes that I've never heard before. I'm hearing hand claps that I never heard before. I'm hearing buried instruments that you were just obscured before, and now they're very clear. And so I've taken a lot more pleasure in the Red and Blue albums than in that song.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting point that touches on both the context of the Beatles work that we just were discussing and also journalism and the way that some of these things are covered. Because I would, in the music press, broadly, when I was seeing the single being covered now and then, it was really about AI, the Beatles, no explanation of exactly what you just said, even though I found this information about, you know, what it was in some more in-depth articles, but those were few and far between. It was all about this headline of AI and the Beatles, AI and the Beatles. And to me, it, you know, I'm with you in the cynical thing. Even though I liked Get Back, it seems like they're kind of calendarized. It's, you know, whatever, 18 months, we're going to get some kind of new piece of Beatles media to keep that, you know, chugging along as a business. And sometimes I worry that, I guess worry is a bad word because I have no invested stake in it one way or the other, but I do feel that these things over time sort of diminish maybe the legacy of the Beatles catalog. You know, if there's ever, I don't know, maybe just the businessy thing of it, maybe it's the burnout, maybe it's the churn. I don't know. The further it gets away from relevance, the more it just feels like it's productized. And I'm starting to see that now with other bands, maybe don't have the same musical legacy, but have a strong cultural legacy, like Kiss with the Kiss hologram announcement when they did their farewell tour. And now they're going to tour these, you know, kind of ridiculous looking hologram simulations of themselves and things like that. And I wonder what these things, these buzzwords and stuff are, if anything, going to, how they're going to impact future listeners who are going to only discover the acts through these strange little gimmicky artifacts. Yeah.
Well, with Kiss, it'd be fun to see someone make the argument that actually is the purest union of form with content, just this fake synthetic hologram. Like, that's, you could say that Kiss was always pointed at that summit. I agree with you. I think that the way we look back on history and the way that people tell their own history, the stories that the Beatles have been telling since their breakup, has changed our perception of what really happened. The problem with Get Back, which I, you know, just found fascinating and I can't wait to rewatch. And I think it's a really wonderful piece of work from Peter Jackson. But the thing I really didn't like about it was how it got sold. So a lot of it comes down to like marketing. Like, yes, can you embrace a product if you disagree with the marketing campaign? Well, of course you can. But what if that marketing campaign is actually like reflects something that's seriously mistaken about our understanding of the product? So for Get Back, it was, oh, you thought the Beatles breakup was really messy. Well, think again, now there's Get Back, you know, now these sessions are not as vituperous as we thought they were. Well, that's just a plain historical anachronism, because the sessions of January 69 was not about a breakup, right? They did not break up. Actually, the triumph of those sessions is that they did not break up. Right, that they went on and used those sessions as a stepping stone to Abbey Road, right? So why did they sell it? Well, the reason they sold it as a breakup, as a sort of a rehabilitation of the breakup, was because when the original Let It Be came out in 1970, there was a great deal of confusion about how the Beatles were breaking up, and yet they had a new album and a movie. And I remember that moment, and it was very confusing. Well, they must not be breaking up then. What is this? We had a lot of trouble figuring out what was going on. McCartney put out his solo album, and then comes a new Beatle album. And we had no idea that it was recorded months before Abbey Road, right? That didn't become clear in the public mind for a long, long time. And so even the Beatles got confused with their breakup, with the, you know, the really complicated and a lot of bad feeling in the breakup got associated with Let It Be, because 1970 was when all of that bad feeling burst out into the open, right, in those court cases. So the Beatles themselves, but when you work in the Beatles space, one of the first things you learn is that the principal figures are not very good witnesses. Like they get stuff wrong constantly. You know, there are, Cynthia Lennon has two memoirs, and she gets her wedding date wrong in both memoirs. I mean, that's the kind of source material that you're working with. So you quickly learn that, if McCartney says it, that doesn't make it so. Okay. So that stuff has been happening a lot all throughout the Beatles' career. You know, how does that affect our view of, well, I think ultimately Get Back actually presents, you know, a much clearer picture of what the sessions felt like and looked like and sounded like in January 69 than anything we've had before. And it's a shame it took them so long, right? But it was that kind of fear of, you know, Jackson describes going to McCartney to tell him, you know, he's looked at the footage and it's actually, there's a lot of great comic stuff in there. And McCartney's so relieved, because all McCartney can remember was what a horrible phase that was. But he's not remembering January of 69. He's remembering the court cases in 1970. So it's a very human thing, but I think ultimately Get Back is a good thing. I think ultimately most of these products, the Revolver box, the White Album box, the Pepper box, the Red and Blue compilations, I mean, these are really, really interesting pieces of work, both in terms of the remastering and in terms of hearing the demos for the first time. A lot of it is stuff we haven't had. And, you know, we have to appreciate, you know, the reason that they got really good at this was because they got ripped off when they were young, right? And so from their point of view, they are busy leveraging all of this material towards earnings that they never got to share it in the first go-round. So they're doing it all a couple generations later. I say more power to them, right? This ought to teach us all a lesson about first contracts that are really exploitative. And I've just, you know, the cynical part of me is really more about, like, every Christmas it's like that. But I gobble those things up like everybody else. The original story, it just wasn't like that. Like when a new Beatle album rolled around and they were working in Alive, the presence was very strong. It was weird. You could feel the Beatles. Like, I remember Abbey Road coming out, and I remember feeling like, oh yeah, it's a new Beatle record. Of course, everyone's in love with the new Beatle record. Let's listen to the Beatle record. Everyone's falling in love with this music all over again. It's fantastic. Of course, it's a new Beatle record. And there was a sense of, like, discovery and shared purpose and a kind of a common bond that you had both with this band that was, you know, just in your imagination, and with everybody who shared that enthusiasm for the band. But it was something that has not been replicated. Just the way we agreed about the Beatles is that Lester Bangs quote about Elvis Presley: we will never agree on anything as much as we agree about Elvis Presley. I really think that's truer of the Beatles. I think more people embrace the Beatles and agree about the Beatles, and that was part of the pleasure. Was You were not going to get slagged for liking the Beatles. It just was no one was doing that, right? And it was just a part of the joy of a new Beatle album. Now we have marketing campaigns, right? So I don't begrudge them any of those. You know, they're one of the few artists in pop culture history who, you know, clearly they deserve the riches that their music has won for them. That's just rare. So they sort of get a waiver on a couple different levels, a different, really different kind of waiver than the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Rolling Stones are much more difficult to parse through because they've actually been on stage, you know, but really, most people just really like, please just stop going on stage, like just enough already. But
well, they've been saying that since the 90s.
They're bored performers. And there are, I've seen clips of even, Lake Charlie Watts shows, and I've seen a couple of those shows. They're really good. We have to create a different context because the original context doesn't work anymore. So, and I would say the Rolling Stones have not been successful at creating a new context that is equal to their talent. Let me just put it that way.
I think there was a failed attempt at recontextualizing the Beatles in the way that you're talking about with the film from a few years ago, Yesterday. I feel like that failed on many, many levels. But the most fundamental level was not addressing within the context of the film that without the Beatles, that ecosystem that the main character was entering with Ed Sheeran and all these other people, the entire entertainment landscape that he was occupying and being lauded in would not have existed in the same way that it existed.
Right.
Just stripping away the Beatles. And then, and at the end, he meets, John Lennon at the beach, still alive or whatever it was. And like, would these songs be as powerful if they were made today? And the conceit was that, oh yeah, they would be worldwide sensations. And I just don't know if that's true because you don't have the cultural context for
right.
it. I don't, it didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was very well thought through. I mean, they could have articulated that contradiction in the piece to express like, we know this is kind of a fiction.
Right.
It would have held my interest a lot more if it had done that. But those are the kinds of projects I've really given up. I mean, and I love Julie Taymor, but here, her Beatle thing, I think is just a disaster, just a giant disaster. I'm much more a fan of that early Beatle movie. I forget what it's called, where they're in Hamburg and the Laura Palmer actress is playing Astrid Kircher.
Mm.
Is that the one with the
overtones, the relationship between Lennon and the other member? Is that the one you're talking about? There were a couple of them.
Cliff.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up because it's embarrassing that.
That's okay.
I can't. No, it's a matter of pride with me. Yeah, it's the Stu Sutcliffe movie, you're right. So
yes.
Beatles. Don't even know how to look for it.
I saw that on television and it was very interesting and it did.
Yeah, I mean, successful recreation of the period and the importance of that period in the public mind has never been articulated very well. Yeah. And it is articulated very well in that movie. I'll get it in a minute here.
Oh, sure. One of the key things that has always stuck with me and kind of painted the way that I viewed the context of the Beatles, obviously being born outside of the time that they were together, is born in 1980, and understanding what that meant was almost just this one line from Hard Day's Night when they're in the train, and it's like a Marx Brothers-y kind of John Lennon quip where, the one guy's being stodgy and, he's like, we fought the war for you. And then, I bet you're sorry that you won. Right.
Sorry that you won. Right.
And to me, that kind of unlocked the whole frame in terms of the generation divide, the cultural difference, that was the key.
Yes. And it's Ringo's line.
Oh, Ringo. Yeah.
Right. And, for the longest time in America, we didn't get that was a first class cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're up in first class and the stuffy old man with the bowler hat, he is a banker or whatever, a suit, a bean counter. And he is appalled that these young hooligans have invaded his cabin. Right. And his complete detest of this young crew and their long hair and their loud music is the older generation. And a lot of older people did feel that way about rock and roll. And it was a very succinct summary of the generation gap going on there. Yeah. And I love how Lennon just turned to him and says, give us a kiss.
No,
Yes, and there was this kind of big disconnect between do you kids understand what kind of sacrifices we made, and the kids did not understand, right? And that there was a very, very real tension there, because if you grow up hearing about this war and hearing these war stories, it just gets boring. But if you went through it, right, it was just a completely different experience of, you know, a life-defining experience for many of those people who actually went through the war, obviously, right? But there was a real disconnect there, because they grew up in the Depression and then went to war, and, you know, their lives were about privation. And so they're looking at this world that they have built and saved from tyranny, and this huge burst of commercial energy and the consumer marketplace that's world historical, and the kids don't seem to appreciate, you know, the sacrifices that were made for it. Yeah, very clearly articulated in that scene.
So what are you currently listening to? Who are some more recent acts that have made it into your rotation?
So I'm very lucky to have two boys, 23 and 26, and they keep me toasty. So on my list last year, which is on my Substack, I put PJ Harvey was number one. I thought that record was a miracle. I still haven't finished listening to it. I'm still kind of in awe of how unusual those songs are. Even though a lot of them use kind of traditional shapes, they sound like the most misshapen, the kinds of songs that should never work, and they work just beautifully. I can't believe what an interesting songwriter she is. I got to write about that record at some point, because I haven't articulated why it's so great. It reminds me a lot of Let England Shake, which I thought was another great record. And then for number two, I put Unknown Mortal Orchestra. And that was largely because the guitar stuff on that record just makes my heart sing. That guy has such a great way of speaking through his guitar. And I love the material on that record, and I love the whole idea of Unknown Mortal Orchestra, but mostly I love the guitar. His romance with the guitar is just luxurious. I just listen to that stuff all day long. I love that. I'm a, you know, a Tame Impala fan. Let's see how to put this. What's the most provocative way I can put this? I'm a convert to the Taylor Swift thing. Right? I went to see the movie, and I found it very impressive. And she has weaknesses, but I think she's real. I think her strengths far outweigh her weaknesses, and I think she's a really important figure. And this football thing is really troubling to me, because, you know, I'm sort of anti-NFL. I'm anti people bashing their brains in, and the concussion trauma and the racism that's alive. It's a very prominent part of NFL culture. And, you know, I hope that, I mean, it's only like 5 years ago that Kaepernick was taking a knee and pissing everyone off. I mean, but, you know, Taylor will take that knee. We know Taylor Swift will take the knee, but will this boyfriend take the knee? Will Kelsey take the knee? You know, that's an open, that's a question. That's a question that she's going to have to confront ultimately. And I think it's going to be a real trial. I think it will be very, very vexing for the country to watch her take a knee. We know in our minds, the people who follow her, and most of our audience knows, yeah, she's on Kaepernick's side. I don't understand why that controversy has not bubbled up to the surface yet. For me, it's just like, any day now, somebody's going to go to Kaepernick and say, what do you think of Taylor Swift going to these games? I think it's very ironic that Taylor Swift, I think, is a really cool progressive role model for today's pop listeners. But I think that leading people to the NFL is leading them in the wrong direction. But I don't really know what to say about that. I do think she gets a private life, and she gets to date whoever she wants. I do think it's kind of out of control. But she's kind of at this place where the Beatles got to, which was it's just, people just went crazy, right? The way people are thinking about Taylor Swift is deeply irrational, right? She has to save the world. She has to redeem womanhood. She has to be like the perfect person. You know, it's like, it's crazy. And nobody can be any of that. And yet the fame that is built up around her has inflated this myth beyond all reckoning. And, you know, I worry about it. I worry about it, because I think the NFL is like a force for evil. Really, I really do. And I sympathize with her. I don't think it's fair that she gets to conduct a private romance and she has no privacy, right? So I just think the whole thing is totally unfair. I'm much more drawn to Beyonce having the number one country single. I think that's fantastic, man. I think that's like, it's about frickin' time. I mean, can you believe that this is the first female, black female who's had a number one country song? I mean, just lump it, you guys. Just lump it. I mean, tough nugs. You don't like this? Tough nugs. You don't understand the roles that black played in the development of your own style of music? There is a whole streak of country western fans that wants to believe that country western is a white nationalist badge, right? Is a badge, is a symbol of white nationalism. And they're just plain wrong. There are white nationalists in country music. There are token blacks in country music. But that doesn't mean that all people who love country music are racist. It basically just means like what it means in most of the music industry. The music is fairly harmless, and the business structures around it are deeply racist and entrenched in racist attitudes and racist systems, and insist on these racist categories. And it causes harm every time.
I remember back in the 90s, not to step over it, but to kind of reinforce your point. Do you remember that act, Hootie and the Blowfish, was very big in the mid 90s?
Yeah.
You know, they're not exactly an artist that I revisit often, but during that time, there was a whole huge uproar about that too, because a lot of people bought that record. This was a time when, you know, people would still hear things on the radio and go and pick up a CD. And there was a big backlash. I lived in the South at the time. People were burning the records. People were running them over with steamrollers and things, because when they found out that the lead singer, Darius, was black, because he didn't, quote unquote, sound black, and they thought they were tricked, right?
Right.
And there was, and I'm surprised and not surprised that instead of untangling that in the time period and getting to a place where we are now, it just left it to fester and kind of be unaddressed for the last 25 years, 30 years.
Well, that's America, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, Grill Marcus writes about this in Mystery Train when Elvis Presley sings his American trilogy, you know, which is, he sings Dixie. I mean, you got Elvis Presley in Vegas, they're singing Dixie and America the Beautiful, and I forget what else, but it's this very purple and schmaltzy and, you know, like velveteen American, just short of Republican National Convention type stuff. And, you know, he says, you know, the Civil War has never been resolved, so Elvis will bring us all together. The complicated part of that is that we're still fighting the Civil War in our heads, and it's deeply tragic that so many people died and that the war is still left unfinished. And in so many people's minds, right, you know, this idea that it was a war of northern aggression, all of the stupid stuff that gets all of the misinformation.
That was taught to me when I was in grade school in Florida. That was how the Civil War was taught to me. We had come, my family had come from New York because my mother had gotten a job down there. And, you know, I was relatively inoculated from the propaganda, but that's how it was presented. That was from the state.
And in Texas too. I mean, we know this. We have the textbooks. I mean, it's just deeply tragic that denial, you know, the South can lose the war, but win the public imagination. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very tragic what Trump has revived in this country. It's the deepest, darkest corners of this country's soul, and we need to reckon with it, you know, and the idea that Republicans still won't reckon with it is deeply troubling.
Right.
It's a fundamental American dilemma that it just feels like it's just harrowing to me that we're still struggling with it. I hate to think about what it must feel like to be a black person in this country in this moment. I just hate it. It's just beyond imagining to me. I feel like I'm so privileged, and us white guys have screwed it up so bad, and we should really just it's it's somebody else's turn to drive now. It just should be somebody else's turn.
What did you think of the Baz Luhrmann Elvis? Because that rehabilitation, reimagination, I mean, the relationship of Elvis to the Black community was a major part of the first probably 1.5-2 acts of that picture. What did you, what was your opinion of that?
Yeah, so I'm so glad you are touching on all this stuff that I've written about, because we can link to it in my Substack stories, but I wrote about it in Substack. You know, I'm mixed. I like the lead performance a lot. It's a very odd movie for me. I really like Tom Hanks, and it's very odd for me to not like Tom Hanks in a movie, and I did not like Tom Hanks in this movie. And I think, to be generous, I think he was misdirected. I think it's a very personal vision of Elvis. I think you have to give Baz Luhrmann his head. He's a stylist that just is, you know, he's going to come at you with that style, you know, and you have to like it or lump it. And there's a way in which, for both Gatsby and this movie, there's a way in which it works in its subject's favor, and then there's a way in which it works against it. I got very tired of it by the end. I felt he dwelt too much on the Vegas stuff at the end. I thought the third act is really problematic, but I don't really want to hear Colonel Tom Parker's story. I mean, I'm not putting money down to go see a movie so that I can learn, you know, what a creep Tom Parker is. I just, you know, like, he's a very unappealing guy, and he behaved appallingly, and that's basically all you need to know. I don't need 2.5 hours of it. I thought the Elvis was really great, really beautifully imagined, beautifully scripted. I thought the stuff where he goes and hangs out on Beale Street was wonderfully done, and it did show a real simpatico. He definitely did hang out with B.B. King, and he did have, you know, he was known for going and singing in blues clubs on Beale Street, which meant singing for Black audiences and holding Black audiences. This is something people don't understand about Elvis, is that the Black audiences loved him at the time. All right. The problem with Elvis is that he didn't pay it back. He didn't sort of behave in a progressive way that said, oh, I'm going to do something for the Black communities that have given us so much rich music. I'm going to build a school here, whatever it is he could do. And Elvis's psychology and his own very poor upbringing, I think, explain a lot of that, but it doesn't let him off the hook. And, you know, he's deeply problematic. I adore the guy. I adore the myth. I adore the singer. I still take a lot of pleasure in his records. I'm deeply saddened by his behavior around the styles that he, you know, I won't say exploited. I think that's actually too simple a term, because I think he's much more, he honors the style so much more than that. But, you know, the styles that made him famous, and he made it, you know, this is another thing it's hard to teach, right? He made it perfectly legitimate for white people to buy records by Black musicians. This was not the norm at the time. Elvis is that gateway. He is, you know, they couldn't segregate the airwaves. And so people were listening to all different kinds of music, and it all got stirred into a new mixture. I mean, that is the magic of the story of young rock and roll. And Elvis is a key part of it, and he plays his role in it. It's much more troubling by the time you get to the end of his career. But obviously he was still like a raving addict, like a lot of these people are, and he was very depressed, and he was, you know, he felt like, I mean, who knows what he felt like, but when you die on the toilet, you're not a happy person. Right? So, you know, you feel sorry for him. I wish his story was different. I thought there were some moments, performative moments in that movie that were quite electric and quite interesting. So that performer I really liked, I forget his name.
Butler.
Right. Yeah. The Beatle movie we were talking about is Backbeat.
That's right. Yeah.
The Beatle movie Backbeat is about their Hamburg days and about Stu Sutcliffe. And that's really a good movie.
Yeah. So people should definitely go and check that out, but they should also go and check out all of your different links and projects and things, hear more about your thoughts on the Elvis movie and, you know, everything that we've talked about here today. So where are the best places for people to find you online and discover your work?
Right. So it's the RileyRockReport.substack.com. That's the bi-monthly newsletter. And then TimRileyAuthor.com. That's where all of my clips are and information about my books and a lot of different podcasts I've been on and all of that stuff. So timreillyauthor.com and Riley Rock Report on Substack.
Thanks for joining me today, Tim. I appreciate it.
Hey, this was really fun. Thank you so much. What a fun conversation.
Visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways that you can help us to continue to create. And I will see you out there.